KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Living in the USA. I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. Later in the show, Hamas's real target in this war is Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. Hussein Ibish will explain. Also, 61 years ago this month, in April 1963, the Birmingham Civil Rights Campaign led by Martin Luther King was reaching a climax. Historian Diane McWhorter will comment. But first, today's political update with Harold Meyerson. Of course, he's editor-at-large of the American Prospect. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
Of course, the big political story this week comes from the crucial swing state of Arizona, which Biden carried in 2020 by 10,000 votes out of 3.2 million, and where there's an open Senate seat right now that has given the Democrats, I would say, a pretty good chance of victory in that race. This week, the State Supreme Court of Arizona upheld an 1864 law that bans nearly all abortions. Would you call this great news for Democrats?
In a word, yes. And it, by the way, it not only bans almost all abortions, but it actually criminalizes, physicians or whoever would perform an abortion, which even in, some of the most benighted other anti-abortion states with their laws does not do that.
I understand you actually know something about this Civil War era law.
Well, I did some research. There was no census of Arizona until 1870, which is 6 years after this law was passed. But in 1870, not counting Native Americans on reservations, I mean, they didn't count them, Arizona had 9,000 residents. Now, if you wind the clock back from 1870 to 1864, A, it had significantly fewer residents, B, in 1864, many of those residents professed loyalty to the Confederacy, not the Union. And of course, we know that women could not vote. So I think all things considered, it is fair to say that the legislature, the first territorial legislature that convened to pass this law, probably was elected by no more than about 1,000 people. That's whence this law cometh. And one of the things they did was that some judge had prepared a sort of a model list of laws from other states that say that they could sort of enact en banc. They, meaning the 9 members of the upper house and the 17 members of the lower house. And they did, whether or not they were even conscious that in this 400-page compendium, there was a law on abortion. We actually don't know that, since this code was adopted just, yes or no for the whole damn thing. So this is what has now become, thanks to the Dobbs decision and now this, the law of the land in Arizona.
I just want to remind our listeners, we've commented on this before, but the ACLU and Planned Parenthood have been gathering signatures to put a referendum on the November ballot in Arizona that would add protection, the right to an abortion, to the state constitution. They say they've already got enough signatures, even though the deadline isn't until July. Carrie Lake, the Trumper and election denier who lost the governor's race in 2020 and is now running the Republican candidate for the Senate, she has praised the abortion ban in her state in the past, but yesterday she said the court's decision was, quote, out of step with Arizonans, close quote. I think you'd have to agree she's right about that.
She is right about that, and her flexibility on this, which is, a nice way of essentially referring to a 180 that she has done on this, because she specifically had praised this 1864 monstrosity and now, understands that she has to repudiate it. Now, this really tilts Arizona towards the Democrats. There's no question about it come November.
And this comes one day after Trump has finally taken a stand on abortion. He said It's not up to him. It's a decision for the states. And now the first state has
spoken right after he said, well, it's up to the states, meaning, oh, it's going to be okay. Well, I don't think a majority of Americans looking at Arizona say it's going to be okay. And I don't think looking back on what enabled, you know, a state to resurrect such a nutsoid law, in other words, the Dobbs decision, which became a decision because Trump had three appointments to the Supreme Court. I don't think they're going to look very kindly on that either. In other words, the Republicans and Trump in particular have been trying to get rid of this issue. And he thought he had done that on Monday. And on Tuesday, it just reared up and bit him in the ass.
And then on Wednesday, of course, he was asked about this. He said he would not sign a national abortion ban if he were elected, which shows which way the winds are blowing in America. He said he expected the Arizona law would be, quote, straightened out. He said he expected the Florida abortion ban, now at 6 weeks, according to that state's Supreme Court, was, quote, probably maybe going to change, close quote. And
probably
then they asked,
maybe?
Probably maybe.
Okay.
And then he was asked whether doctors who provide abortions should be punished. And he said, I'd let that be up to the states. You know, everything we're doing now is states' rights, close quote. I looked this up. There are 16 red states that currently have laws making it a crime punishable by years in prison for a doctor to provide an abortion. In Florida, Ron DeSantis recently signed a law saying doctors would get 5 years in prison for performing an abortion. Texas also has a 5-year prison sentence. And in Alabama, it's 10 to 99 years. So more examples of what happens when you leave it up to the states.
So that doesn't strike, I think, most Americans as a suitable remedy. Of course, even living in Alabama can be viewed as something of a sentence. But
we'll be getting to another Alabama story a little later in this broadcast. Okay. And then the Democrats this week released a new abortion TV ad. I have to say, this one is a killer. A young woman named Amanda describes how when she was pregnant, she got an infection that nearly killed her because of the Texas law that prohibits abortions even when they are medically necessary. She sobs about the loss of the baby as she goes through the clothing the baby was going to wear if it had lived. The baby was going to be named Willow. Viewers then see a black screen with the single phrase, Donald Trump did this. You can see that video online. Just search for abortion and Trump did this.
This is one reason why, despite any number of current polls, not rule out the possibility of a Biden victory.
And that's because the polls often are of the likely voters, which is defined by the pollsters as people who have voted in the past. This is the sort of thing that will bring unlikely voters to the polls. They are called the low propensity voters. So the Democrats are hoping for a bigger turnout of women who will want to enshrine abortion rights in their state constitutions. Well, now it's time for news of the class struggle in America. That's a regular feature of this broadcast. We've had a wave of corporate challenges to the National Labor Relations Act filed by Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos, and by the guy who owns a Trader Joe, the Albrecht family. You report in The Prospect that these challenges are many and varied. Where do we stand on this front of the class war?
Well, let's be clear that the National Labor Relations Act was declared constitutional by the Supreme Court about 18 months after it was enacted. That is to say, in 1937, or as Lincoln might have put it, 47 years ago, that since 1937, it hasn't really been challenged since. There's a couple of ways that these corporations, SpaceX and Amazon, lawyers are going about this. They say, well, it relegates too many decisions to the administrative bodies. That is to say, in this case, the judicial process that goes on when the allegations that either unions or corporations or employers make are heard before NLRB judges who decide, you know, if in fact labor law has been violated. That was something that the Supreme Court said okay in 1937, and it's similar to processes by which the Securities and Exchange Commission and Trade Commission and all sorts of the administrative state that was set up during the New Deal, essentially to protect Americans against, you know, and corporate abuse, are now being called into question precisely because the Biden administration is taking those various agencies seriously and has appointed to them people like Lina Khan at the Federal Trade Commission, who takes antitrust law seriously, and Jennifer Abruzzo at the National Labor Relations Board, who believes that, you know, employers who break the law by doing things like firing workers who are involved in union activities actually, you know, should be penalized. And that's what they're pushing back on. That's what the NLRB is pushing back on.
And so this is a challenge to the whole conception of administrative bodies that enforce the law that Congress passed. I guess it's constitutional because it is about separation of powers and what administrative law includes. I always thought administrative law was boring.
Well, actually, I was on this webinar yesterday with General Counsel Abruzzo and a number of labor law academics, one of whom was quoting a right-wing attorney who deals with the laws and the processes of administrative law bodies, saying precisely that, you know, I was used to administrative law being boring. Now it's not. And,
it's,
you know,
not.
The reason it's not is because it's actually being enforced, which under, you know, most presidential administrations since Ronald Reagan, and in some cases since Jimmy Carter, they have not been. And now they are being enforced. And specifically, you know, Musk got involved in this when the NLRB said, you know, it's illegal for you to have fired 8 workers at SpaceX, one of your many companies, because they were involved in union activities. So, you know, Musk hired a very high-priced law firm, which decided to try every argument under the sun, and so too with Bezos at Amazon, since he's afraid of Amazon workers joining and forming unions. So this is there, and in part, one of the things Jennifer Abruzzo said yesterday is this is also intended to divert the NLRB's rather limited resources to, you know, waging these court battles instead of enforcing labor law, though she made very clear that they were going to continue to enforce labor law.
Well, one of the many fronts of the class war in America is found in Vance, Alabama. This is near Tuscaloosa, and it's the site of America's only Mercedes assembly plant. Workers there just filed for an NLRB election. They say they want the UAW to represent them in negotiations. That's big, but there's a bigger story at play in Vance, Alabama. The story you've just been telling at the Prospect, that started 25 years ago in 1999 at the Seattle WTO protests.
Yeah, well, the Seattle WTO protests went beyond, you know, a lot of justifiably angry people sitting in the streets and keeping the WTO from convening. It also included a really remarkable gathering of about 10,000 workers and union members from all over the world at the AFL-CIO put on. And I was there for the whole shebang in Seattle, covering it for the LA Weekly at the time. And I remember a young man who was a worker at a Ford factory in South Africa saying, "Look, all of the employees of Ford, some are covered by contracts, some are not. Some are have labor standards set down by their government, some are not. Look, it's still a Ford factory. Why isn't there some kind of uniform code?" So that was 25 years ago, and essentially nothing happened. It was a great idea. But then, a couple of years ago in Germany, at the insistence of some German unions and the Social Democratic Party, Germany enacted a new law which said that German-based companies that go abroad, of which are legions, Mercedes, Siemens, Bayer, Aspirin, you name it, have to adhere to these certain very clear standards that we enforce on them in here in Germany. And one of them is the right, a worker's right, untrammeled right to join unions or form unions. All of a sudden, this is germane in Alabama, not just German in Alabama, it's germane in Alabama.
But doesn't the United States already have the same law that penalizes companies that don't allow workers to exercise the right to form unions?
It does, but it's a more serious violation in Germany. Under American labor law, if Mercedes fires a worker for being involved in union activity, the company is eventually required to rehire that worker, give him or her their back pay, and post a little notice saying, "Oh, we have now complied with the National Labor Relations Act." Under German law, if the equivalent to the NLRB in Germany finds that a worker has been illegally fired, the penalty could range up to 2% of the company's global revenues in the last year, which in the case of Mercedes would be 3 billion euros, and withholding government German government contracts from that company. So someone at the UAW became aware of this and filed a complaint with the German agency a few days before the UAW announced it had filed it for an election at that Vance, Alabama plant, which was sort of a warning shot to managers that even though managers of auto plants in the South, run amok abusing workers when union status is on the line, there's a new cop on the block in Berlin. Watch it, bud.
So the German version of the NLRB could require that Mercedes in Vance, Alabama, permit a union, an NLRB election. Does the UAW think that this complaint filed in Germany will really result in German sanctions against the Tuscaloosa plant?
Well, the timing, again, a few days before their workers filed for UAW status there, the timing suggests that they think of it probably as one more factor that could constrain the managers from being complete, just to run roughshod over their workers. In general, the UAW, which also the UAW was also involved in an election that'll take place between April 17th and April 19th at the Volkswagen factory in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They're really riding on a lot of momentum after they won their strike against the big three auto companies. I think they pretty much expect to win the Volkswagen plant. And given that the NLRB has put a real limits on corporations' ability to stall elections, I think the vote at the Mercedes plant will probably be, either the end of May or early June. And this is basically intended to say, look, you've got eyes on you, watching what you do, Mercedes managers, with more serious consequences if you really run amok than you've been known to before. And it would be obviously a huge, huge breakthrough in American labor relations if unions start or organizing successfully organizing the South again. That's
And
been.
in the prospect, you point to one very telling example of how one small, potentially significant strategic step by organized workers can have huge effects on companies. And that's what happened with Starbucks and that stockholder challenge. Remind us about that story.
Well, at Starbucks, the annual shareholder meeting was coming up in mid-March, and there was a pro-barista slate of three people with a great deal of experience in labor relations, including the head of Barack Obama's NLRB, Wilma Liebman, a terrific labor lawyer, who were running, backed by the SEIU, which is sort of the parent of the parent union of the grandparent union of the baristas, as it were. And this was just one more thing that Starbucks management just didn't want to deal with and add to the bad press they've been getting for firing baristas hither and yon when different outlets were going union. So it was one of many factors, I think, that contributed to Starbucks saying, okay, we'll sit down and negotiate a national contract, which negotiations are going on right now.
And just remind us, what had Starbucks' position been before this?
Oh, it was completely intransigent. They refused to bargain pretty much anywhere. 400 Starbucks outlets had voted to unionize, and they were not getting any sit downs with Starbucks lawyers. So, and Starbucks was firing baristas, across the board, and they were withholding raises that they had given every other Starbucks outlet from those that had unionized, which is a very questionable legality. So this for Starbucks, assuming they go through with what they've said they're going through with, would be a 180. And in these kinds of campaigns, which are huge breakthroughs, because really up until now, all of the rather considerable unionization campaigns that have succeeded over the last couple of years have been among people who managers can't fire because they can't easily be replaced. University teaching assistants, interns and residents, museum docents, you name it. If you're a barista, if you're an assembly line worker in an auto plant, you can be fired. So, and no one has, for that reason, unions haven't really even seriously tried to organize most of those workers over the last few decades because they know they'd lose. That may be about to change, and that would be a huge change to the American political economy.
Finally, it's time for a new episode of Where's Melania? It's an occasional feature of this broadcast. On Saturday, the former First Lady joined Donald Trump at a campaign event for only the second time since he's been campaigning for president for re-election. This was at a fundraising dinner in Palm Beach. There were photos of the event where Melania, frankly, did not look happy. Ron Filipkowski, editor-in-chief of Midas Touch, tweeted, quote, "Melania looks like she's in a hostage video. Blink twice if you need help," close quote. Some recalled that she left the White House in 2021 with the lowest ratings of any first lady in history. Harold, we turn to you for insight into the thinking of Melania Trump as she contemplates returning to the White House and helping her husband achieve that.
I sense a certain reluctance. I mean, when she married Trump, she kind of knew what she was getting. But, state power was not on the list. that had been mysteriously omitted. And now that it's there, I think she thinks she needs that like a hole in the head.
Harold Meyerson, read him at prospect.org. Thank you, Harold.
Always good to be here, John.
Ooh. 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 Same old story back again. It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. We have a question about Hamas. Why did they decide to provoke a massive Israeli response now? For comment, we turn to Hussein Ibish. He's a senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington. He's written for The Atlantic, The Daily Beast, The New Republic, and The New York Times, and he's appeared widely on the network news shows. Hussein Ibish, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, John. Thank you.
A near universal assumption is that Hamas viewed its surprise attack on October 7th as the opening to another phase in a long-term war against Israel. You say there's some truth to that, but there's a different reason that explains why they did it now. Please explain.
Of course, Hamas does see itself in a long-term war with Israel, although that's, you know, the contours of that are to be defined over time. But I think the reason for the October 7 attack, the timing of it, the nature of it, and virtually all of its specific contours and attributes were shaped not by the Palestinian-Israeli relationship or the Hamas-Israeli relationship, but rather by internal Palestinian power struggle, by internal Palestinian power dynamics, and a kind of a partisan competition between Hamas and the secular nationalists in Fatah. Hamas was founded in 1987 during the crucible of the First Intifada, the first uprising by ordinary Palestinians against Israeli military rule, in where there was a kind of vacuum of leadership. And at the time, it was left-wing grassroots committees that were directing the uprising. And then the PLO, which was kind of the secular nationalist organization, began to claw back control of the movement. But there was an opening, and the Muslim Brotherhood in Gaza founded Hamas with the founding directive of trying to marginalize the secular nationalists, take over the national movement, and make the Palestinian cause in the long run an Islamist one run by them. And that has never changed. They've made a lot of progress over the decades in getting there, but they still don't have control of the national movement. They are in control of Gaza, but not of Area A in the West Bank, which is the sort of prime real estate under Palestinian control. And more importantly, they don't control or even belong to the PLO.
The opinion polls show that this Hamas strategy worked for a while after October 7th, to dramatically increase support for Hamas among Palestinians, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, and to weaken Hamas's rivals, as you have said, Fatah and the Palestinian Authority. But you say things are changing now in this power struggle within the Palestinian movement. You wrote recently about what you called a mood shift among Palestinians. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I think you are starting to see a mood shift, and there are a number of pieces of evidence for it. One is there's a lot more grumbling coming out of Gaza about Hamas, about what did they do to us, about what on earth did they mean by this attack? How could they play with our lives like that? And I think after October 7, it was a sentiment that got buried, both in terms of public opinion on the ground and in terms of what the Fatah leaders were, like Mahmoud Abbas and others, were willing to say about Hamas, underneath the kind of shared outrage at Israel's behavior in Gaza and a kind of rally around the flag and national solidarity and all of that. But over time, what's happened is, I think the question has started to be raised, about what did Hamas think it was doing? Now, that's a question that will become almost inevitable and in a very dangerous way for Hamas if Israel were to leave Gaza anytime in the near term. But as long as Israel's there, it does sort of suppress the impulse to ask the question. Nonetheless, the question is being asked more and more, and you can see it in the kind of statements that are getting out into the media, and certainly in the Fatah response to Hamas's criticisms.
Yes, you quote Fatah in your piece in The Daily Beast, saying that Hamas was responsible for, quote, a Nakba that is more severe than the 1948 Nakba. That sounds pretty strong.
It's the strongest thing you can say in Palestinian national politics. I mean, the Nakba 48 represents the destruction of Palestine as a society. I mean, before the 1947-48 war, there was a Palestinian society, a country in a fledgling country. It was there. It was you know, coming into being. And at the end of the war, it was gone. And most of the Palestinians were outside of historical Palestine and were refugees. And the national movement was decimated for decades. So if you say this is a Nakba, a calamity, worse than the calamity of 48, you're saying it's worse than the worst. It's like saying worse than the Holocaust among Jews. And I think what you point to there is the fact that, you know, he got 35,000 people killed in a few months. And that's a number that is off the charts in terms of dead Palestinians. So it's not a silly thing to say. It's just a very strong thing to say.
And while a million Palestinians in Gaza are homeless, Fatah said Hamas leaders now, quote, live a life of luxury in seven-star hotels, a reference to Qatar, where the Hamas leadership lives now. That's on a different register, but still a very powerful point.
It's a powerful point. I mean, the Hamas Politburo was expelled from Gaza, went to Syria, and then they fled Syria in 2012 during the Arab Spring uprisings and ended up in Qatar. And they've been there living a life of relative luxury. And it's in stark contrast to the kind of life of martyrdom and sacrifice, struggle and, you know, blood, toil and tears that they prescribe to ordinary people. Now, there's a contrast here, which is the leadership on the ground in Gaza. Yahya Sinwar, the political and sort of maximum Hamas leader, and Mohammed Daif, the paramilitary leader, who are presumably in tunnels underground underneath Khan Yunis or underneath southern Gaza somewhere. And they don't live lives of luxury. But the former Politburo or the Politburo leaders, who are now the diplomats of Qatar, do. And it's a way of jabbing at them for sure. And it's not false.
We talked earlier about the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, which Hamas would like to control. How important is the PLO to the Palestinian cause internationally?
Yeah, so this is the thing people need to understand. The PLO's diplomatic standing and global presence is the crown jewel in the Palestinian sort of hat, coronet, whatever they've created since 1967 and the rejuvenation of the Palestinian national movement under Arafat and beyond. The main thing that the Palestinians have built that Israel can't take away from them is exactly the international role and standing and presence of the PLO. So we've got 130 missions around the world, embassies, you know, other missions everywhere, and non-member observer state status in the UN General Assembly and membership in countless multinational and multilateral organizations, from UNICEF to the WHO to, I mean, all kinds of things. And whoever gets up to speak for the Palestinians in an international forum, whether it's the Arab League, at the UN, in any of these organizations, at embassies all over the world, is going to be a PLO representative. And Hamas has never been a part of the PLO. It's never participated in the PLO. And until Hamas gains control over that international voice, it can't really pretend to speak for the Palestinians. At the same time, Hamas not being part of the PLO and not being in sync with Fatah is a problem for the Palestinians, because you have this big faction that's kind of outside the whale, and the Israelis take advantage of it a lot. But it's still the case that Hamas needs to claw that international voice away from their secular rivals.
And what exactly was Hamas's situation on the eve of October 7th? Where did they stand at that point in their rivalry with Fatah?
They were in a really bad situation, actually. And I think people who followed the Middle East closely knew how dire their situation was, but I think a lot of us, or very few of us, knew what they were going to do or had a sense that they were going to lash out. But yeah, they were in big trouble. First of all, I think Gaza had turned more and more into a kind of a quagmire for them rather than a launching pad. They seemed to be stuck there, just kind of bogged down in Gaza, couldn't get back into the West Bank, and just kind of trapped in this little sort of hole in Gaza. They were losing support from their international backers, from Turkey and from Qatar. Both of them were saying, you got to do more for yourself. The Turks kind of pulling away from them diplomatically. The Qataris kind of suggesting that they weren't interested in continuing to pay the bills for Hamas on an ongoing basis. And then also Hamas was losing its brand, because Hamas's competitive advantage against the PLO, the PA and Fatah has been armed struggle. Because since 1993, the PLO, the PA and Fatah have staked everything on negotiating a two-state agreement with Israel, whereas Hamas continues to use the rhetoric, if not the practice, always of armed struggle. And there are these youth groups that have cropped up in the West Bank, in the old city of Nablus, the Lion's Den, in the Jenin refugee camp, the Jenin Brigades, and others. Young men with guns, doing what young men with guns do, and certainly confronting Israeli occupation soldiers and armed settlers. And so they were becoming the vanguard of the confrontation with armed Israelis, whether it was armed Israeli soldiers or armed Israeli settlers. And so Hamas was even losing their one main brand, which was armed struggle. So they were in big trouble. And I think they really felt that something needed to be done. The worst thing was they could see that whatever benefits Palestinians were going to get, no matter how limited, from a U.S.-Israeli-Saudi agreement, were all going to go to Fatah in the West Bank. And it was going to be money from Saudi Arabia. It was going to be some political goodies for the PA, maybe even some additional standing for the PLO. And they just couldn't afford it. The Palestinian national scene was very evenly divided, a delicate equilibrium. And I think a Saudi American finger was going to come down on the scale on the other side of the equilibrium from Hamas. And they thought it's got to be stopped. And they did stop it. And I think that was a very key reason why they acted when they did.
So, the United States in all this, what should be the political goal of the United States in of Israel if they seriously want to defeat Hamas?
Well, if they want to defeat Hamas, they need to understand what Hamas' political goal is and recognize that Hamas' political goal is internal to the Palestinian national movement. It's not primarily to do with Israel, though eventually it may be. It's not mainly about Iran and the Saudi-Israeli thing as a regional issue, but rather about the competition for power between Palestinian Islamists and Palestinian secularists. And that's where the name of the game really is. If you want to defeat Hamas and thwart Hamas and answer October 7 on its own terms, it's not enough to deal Hamas blows from the outside. You've got to support their rivals. Otherwise, it won't be a defeat for them. Otherwise, it'll be a matter of them kind of like brazening it out and toughing it out and then emerging, waving the bloody shirt, which is the ultimate banner of power and victory, and saying, look, we are the national movement. We are the right ones. You know, we are the true people. These guys in the West Bank aren't doing anything. They're ridiculous. We are fighting Israeli occupation forces every day for control of Palestinian land in Gaza. We're dying. We're killing. We're doing everything that men do in a freedom struggle, and the others aren't. And that's because we are the national movement, and we should be the representatives internationally as well. And we are really the only ones who stand for the people. And that's what they want to say. And so to deny them that, you've got to bolster the others. There's no other way. The bottom line is, if you want to defeat Hamas, you have got to strengthen the PLO, the PA, and Fatah. There's no other way. Otherwise, ultimately, Hamas will win.
The only way to truly defeat Hamas is to strengthen the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, and Fatah. That's the conclusion of Hussein Ibish. He wrote about it for The Daily Beast. Hussein Ibish, you've convinced me. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you, John. Anytime.
It's the same old story. This is Living in the USA, and I'm John Wiener, talking about politics, thinking about the left. 61 years ago this week, in April 1963, the Birmingham Civil Rights Campaign, directed by Martin Luther King, was reaching a climax. April 7th, Palm Sunday that year, was the day police used dogs to attack black people at a march. The dramatic photos appeared on front pages around the world. Then, four black girls were killed when the Ku Klux Klan bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church. The events prompted Congress to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the most far-reaching civil rights legislation in a century. Diane McWhorter wrote the definitive history of that crucial campaign. Her book is called Carry Me Home, Birmingham, Alabama, The Climactic Battle of the Civil Rights Revolution. I spoke with Diane McWhorter about it in 2001.
You grew up in Birmingham on what you call the wrong side of the revolution. Please explain.
Well, I grew up in what was called Over the Mountain, which was the barrier between the gritty city and the sort of bucolic suburbs. And I was part of this prominent civic family, and my father was the sort of renegade son of this family, and he was sort of a vigilante spirit who had started attending what he called civil rights meetings, by which he meant he was working on ways to stop the civil rights movement. So I had this sort of split vision and started being worried that he was flirting with the Ku Klux Klan. So that was probably the emotional impetus for my writing the book.
Your book opens at an elite country club on what turns out to be the morning when four black girls were killed in that church bombing in 1963. I gather you were at the country club that Sunday morning. How old were you, and how did that bombing affect you at the time?
Well, I was 10 at the time, and I assume I was there, but I don't have any recollection of it, which was also a reason I wrote the book, because I don't remember finding out about the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, even though when President Kennedy was assassinated only 2 months later, I have total recall of everything. So when I realized that, I was just stunned at the lack of appropriate consciousness I had about this horrible thing that had happened, apocalypse really, that had happened in my city. I learned later from reading my mother's date book that the rehearsal of a civic production of The Music Man that I was in was canceled, but that was not in deference to the victims, but because the white people were afraid that the African Americans were going to be rioting because they were so upset. So that was, that was sort of the context in which I experienced it.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing to discover. Of course, what the rest of the country and indeed the world remembers Birmingham for are those photographs of the police dogs attacking black nonviolent demonstrators. You had actually seen these same police dogs at your school, didn't you?
Oh yeah, the Canine Corps, as it was called, was sort of a local. They were local celebrities, and the handlers, the human handlers, took the dogs on tour around for school assemblies, and they came to my school, and I think it was Rebel was the dog who attacked there was a police woman there who was wearing some kind of protective vest, and he attacked her, and it was all very exciting. I was so excited about it that I briefly wanted to become a dog handler for the Birmingham Police.
Wow.
I'd initially wanted to be on the U.S. equestrian team, so you can see what my little girl priorities were.
Well, you've come down in the world, I
yeah,
must
exactly.
say.
Yeah, exactly.
Your book goes into the history of Birmingham, a steel town. U.S. Steel was the company that owned the mines and the mills there. You write about terrorists on the payroll at U.S. Steel. What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, it was conventional wisdom that the heavy manufacturing industry in Birmingham really benefited from segregation and sort of enforced it in certain ways and encouraged it. But I was really shocked to discover the extent to which they had directly sponsored terrorism. When the unions started coming to organize in Birmingham, the steel industry in Birmingham in the 30s, backed by Franklin Roosevelt's government, U.S. Steel had actual headbusters, leg breakers on their payroll. And one in particular was sort of at the hub of this network of anti-union, this anti-union machine, which included propaganda, it included the American Legion, the newspapers collaborated in this. It was, you know, it was really quite a widespread network, and that was the resistance that morphed into the segregationist resistance later, because the issue on which the industrialists could beat the union, they found, was white supremacy. If they turned the white workers against the black workers, then they could be pretty much assured that the unions would remain weak because the workforce would be divided.
And where does the Ku Klux Klan appear in this history?
Well, the Klan was Klan initially fought the union in the 30s, and what happened was the industrialists no longer felt like they could keep these vigilantes on their payroll, so they turned to political intermediaries. And in the case of Birmingham, it was none other than Bull Connor, who was the cartoon villain of the civil rights era, who unleashed the dogs and hoses on the demonstrators in 63. He had been installed in City Hall by the industrialists in 1937 as sort of this anti-New Deal mascot, and it was he who became the intermediary between the interests, the industrial interests, and the Klan. He had his own kind of errand boy inside the Klan, who in the 40s, who, believe it or not, grew up to become the bomber of the 16th Street Baptist Church. So all these connections were much more direct and sort of insidious than I had suspected when I started the book.
We're speaking with Diane McWhorter. She's the author of a wonderful new book, Carry Me Home, Birmingham, Alabama, The Climactic Battle of the Civil Rights Revolution. Bull Connor was, of course, the world-famous symbol of resistance to integration in 1963. You write that he got his start as a cornball radio personality. How did he get from there to having so much power in Birmingham?
Well, he was in the 30s. He was a really popular baseball announcer, and baseball had been the sort of opiate of the masses. It was really the only thing that kept a lot of people going, cheerful during the Depression. So he became this real cult figure as a result of that. His fans drafted him to run for the state legislature in 1934, and then the big mules, as the industrialists were called in Birmingham, recognized that he would make a much better executive than he did a legislator. So they're the ones who got him elected to City Hall in 1937. So he was just the perfect head of the industrialists, who was able to speak to the have-nots and kind of turn them against the policies of the New Deal that had really been designed to uplift them. He persuaded them that it was social engineering designed to bring about the breakdown of the races. So that's, he got his start on the platform of white supremacy, and of course it culminated in the scenes that we all know about.
You argue that Bull Connor's heavy-handed repression of the demonstrations led by Martin Luther King was crucial to the successes that the civil rights movement had in Birmingham in 1963. I wonder if Martin Luther King and his lieutenants in Birmingham saw it that way.
Well, yeah, they did. I'm not. It's a little hazy on whether they actually knew it going in there, but certainly immediately afterward, they did know that that violence on the part of the segregationists was really crucial to the success of nonviolence as a strategy. Coming into Birmingham, King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, was going nowhere slowly. They had a really kind of humiliating defeat in Albany, Georgia, partly because the police chief there was so polite. They said he killed the movement with kindness. He would bow his head when he made the arrest. The Kennedys applauded him for being so reasonable, and they realized that in order to dramatize the plight of the race, they really needed this graphic evil. And President Kennedy sort of joked after the Birmingham demonstrations, joked to King and some civil rights leaders who were at the White House, you know, I don't really don't think you should be that hard on Bull Connor. He's probably done more for civil rights than anybody in this era. Hmm. And that was ironically true.
Bull Connor did more for civil rights than anyone in the era. The Birmingham campaign was 61 years ago this week, in April 1963. We spoke with Diane McWhorter about her book, Carry Me Home, in 2001. That's it for today's Living in the USA. Our social media maven is Renee Reynolds. Thanks as always to Rye Cooter for our theme music, Mambo Sinuendo. Living in the USA is recorded and produced at our Blythe Avenue studios in Los Angeles. If you miss part of this show or any of our recent shows, you can listen online anytime you want at livinginTheUSApod.com. I'm John Wiener. We'll be back next week talking about politics, thinking about the left, and living in the USA.